session number 27075, reel 3.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 3. So obviously at this time you've mentioned that you knew there was a war coming, but from a personal point of view, do you have any memories of the Munich crisis in 1938?
Oh, indeed, yes. Yes, I think I've got pretty sharp recollections, particularly, of course, of Chamberlain coming back and waving his bit of paper, climbing out of the aeroplane. That's an image which I suppose is etched on millions of minds. I know my mother was quite ecstatic. People of her generation were really understandably terrified that there might be another war, having passed through the first one. And like most people of her generation, it was one of the most wonderful things that had happened for a long while. War had been averted. For me, I think I was a bit lukewarm about it, because Menach and McCudden and Ball are going to have got something to live up to. There were young chaps coming along who were going to show them a thing or two.
Did you know about the exploits of the Aces in the First World War?
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes. Yes, I bought all the books. I had Popular Flying was my weekly thing, and of course Flight Magazine. And then, of course, stacks and stacks of books about the World War I Aces. I read them all cover to cover and several times, I think. Yes.
And if there was a war coming, you said you were lukewarm. Was that because you would harbour the wish to join the RAF?
Well, no, because this chap Chamberlain was mucking things up, you see. No, we couldn't have that.
So you definitely had a desire to join the RAF?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Had you considered joining the auxiliary or the volunteer reserve at all?
Well, I did. I joined the volunteer reserve, yeah. Auxiliary was a bit upmarket, especially where I lived at Wembley. The two auxiliary squadrons, 600 and 601. These were the stockbrokers' squadrons. But the volunteer reserve was open to a much wider range. And yes, I slapped on my application on my 18th birthday. It all moved quite quickly. I think I was up at the town centre at Store Street in London, being interviewed within weeks. Yes.
What did the interview entail? The initial interview.
What did they want to know? I think. Probably they started off with sports, which were all important, of course, in those days. What games do you play? I think that was the opening gambit. Do you have any hobbies? I think if this was a sort of opening field. And then, well, why do you want to join the Air Force, you know, casually? What do you want to join the Air Force for? And of course, that was where one had to let rip.
So, what did you say?
Oh, I said, well, I said I'm a student at Hawker Aircraft. I'm building the Hurricane almost single-handed. I want to fly one. Oh, I see.
So they, how did it? When you said that you worked for Hawkers, was there a perceivable interest in them when you actually said who you were working for and what you were doing at the time?
I don't think he was wide-eyed. No, I think he was taking notice, yes, yes.
And you were interviewed by a serving RAF officer?
I was wondering about that, whether he's in uniform or not. I think he must have been. I think he's probably a squadron leader in uniform. Or maybe a wing commander, I'm not sure. But it was a relatively brief interview, as far as I recall. The next thing, the papers arrived for signature.
Did you have to get your parents to sign them, or of you were 18?
Yes, my father had to sign. Yeah.
How did he feel about signing for you to join?
Oh, quite happily. He was in the army during the First World War, captain in the 13th Kensington Regiment. And he didn't raise any objection at all.
With your parents, you've mentioned, were they keen that you would go into, say, the RAF rather than the army?
Well, they didn't express any opinion, no. But it was they knew if they had, no, they were fighting a losing battle.
Were your parents very supportive of your...
Oh, I think so, but my father was very busy. He was a manager at the BTH works at the Easton. So he was very busy. Undoubtedly, although he didn't say anything about it, undoubtedly they were gearing up for war production. My mother, of course, she'd got a family of four. We were fairly widespread in ranges. Because my brother was born in 1918. Or was it 19? 19 he was born. And then my sister would have been 28, I think, 28, quite a widespread. So she was a very busy person. Looking back, it seems that I had pretty well a free hand. The things I wanted to do, they sort of went my way. Even when I announced something like, I'm going up to the Warner Cinema in Leicester Square to see a film or something like that, they wouldn't say, oh, by yourself. Yes, I had a pretty free hand. Mm.
So you had no problems getting the papers signed?
No, none at all. Papers went in and came back, and I was in the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, and I had to report to Store Street in London once a week for ground subjects, learning Morse code, would you believe?
What did that entail then, actually, learning Morse code? Would you sit in a classroom environment? Yeah.
How do we do it now? Do we have earphones? I can't remember. But we certainly sat there tapping away madly, yeah.
Who was instructing you?
I think they must have been civilians. Yes, I would think so. I can't place people in uniform. And indeed, you see, much of the training was done by civilians. In fact, many of the, I think most of the elementary flying schools. I went to Perth. Well, Perth was run by what used to be their local flying club. I forget their name. But they were the local flying club with their own airfield at Scone. The instructors, the flying instructors, were a mixture of civilian and service. My own instructor was a sergeant pilot in the Royal Air Force. Others had civilian instructors, and the ground subjects were taken by civilian instructors.
What other ground subjects were you doing? You mentioned Morse code, but yeah. What other things were you, the very...
Oh, Morse code. We did Morse code. We did navigation. We did rules of the air. We did airmanship.
What are rules of the air?
Rules of the air. Well, an aircraft on a collision course, one has to give way. One with the aircraft on its starboard side shall give way. That sort of thing. It was a part of the airmanship. We had a Bible called airmanship, and rules there were part of that Bible. I think that was about it.
And you would do this once a week, would you?
Go up once a week. Yes.
What day would that be? Would it be a specific day, or would it be different days?
I think I'd be up there on the Tuesday, I think.
And was it a day's instruction while you were there, or would it be an evening?
Oh, an evening, yes.
So
yes,
there was yes. no support, obviously, from your employer?
No. I think if it had been necessary, they'd have let me go. But no, we didn't have to be there until 7 in the evening. So it was flogging up to Dawl Street, and then 7 in the evening, and then I think it probably lasted for a couple of hours, then back to Wembley, then off down to Kingston in the morning.
And what about your fellow volunteers? What kind of backgrounds were they from?
Oh, everything under the sun. Yes, very, very... A huge cross-section. Public school boys, university men, in fact. Public school boys, grammar school boys, elementary school boys. The whole range. And then as far as professions are concerned, I remember one... one was a barrister. There were one or two engineers, accountants. Quite a few were I can't think what else they were doing, but it was a big broad band. Mm.
And they would you say they were all motivated by the wish to fly, or were people motivated to do a duty for the coming
war? Oh, no, they all wanted to be pilots. Oh, yes, we were enlisted as pilots, sergeant pilots under training. We were AC2s for one day, and the next day we were sergeants. And the joke was, of course... When we were mobilised, a couple of weeks before the war broke out, we were summoned to Saw Street to get our uniforms. So we all went up, got all the stuff on, went back home, kit bag, and gas mask and everything. And then a telegram came. I think it was on the day the war broke out, I think a telegram came. Report to Liverpool Street Station at such time, platform so and so, carrying kit bag, RAF Volunteer Reserve. And so off I went. And there were these hundreds of chaps, all in these shapeless uniforms, hats stuck on at all angles. You never saw such a motley throng. But the joke was, we were all wearing sergeant stripes. And we got on the train and went to Cambridge, disembarked at Cambridge, formed up in what was supposed to be some sort of order, and marched off through the town to all the various colleges where we were going to be accommodated. And there we were, all marching down through the high street, through Cambridge, and all the local people staring at these, you could see them saying, "Sergeants!" And of course, among the passers-by would have been old sweats from Duxford and nearby airfields who'd taken about 25 years to get their three stripes. And there were these fresh-faced kids with their three stripes the day they joined up. It was all very unjust, I'm sure.
How had you reacted actually when war had finally broken out, though? What were your feelings then?
Oh, well, this is what we've been waiting for. Oh, yes, it was going to happen. It was all going to happen now.
Had you actually done any flying training prior to the outbreak of war?
I should have done, but it didn't materialise. In addition to being ordered to grow it to a Store Street, I was posted to... something elementary flying training school at Woking, and it's not the name of the airfield, it's got another name. Anyway, it's Woking, and I was supposed to start flying training there as soon as told to do so. In the meantime, await instructions, which never came, and war broke out, and I never got to Woking. What's it called? Double barreled name. Never mind.
Was there a bit of a backlog, obviously, with the recruitment to the volunteer reserve at that period?
A backlog?
Of trainee pilots in that period?
I think at the outbreak of war, we were just about on target, because when we got to Cambridge and were allocated to our various colleges, and it became clear that some of the people had already started flying training. There were a few who had got as many as 30 hours, maybe 40 hours flying in. These tended to be the older ones who'd been around a while. Then you got to those who maybe had done 1 or 2 hours. And then those who hadn't actually started at all. I think the split probably was about 50-50 between those who'd done at least some and those who hadn't done any at all. Yeah. And that would have been from, I suppose, at Magdalen, we were about, 150, I suppose.
Mm. Where were you accommodated in the college? Was it
in the college? In the college rooms, yes. Yes. Just a bare room. Some of the occupants had departed at high speed for various reasons, left all their belongings behind. So those chaps who happened to go up the right staircase and dived into the right through the right door, we were simply told, go and find a room, you know. Dived into the right door, and some of them found them completely furnished. I wasn't so lucky. I dived and found it was an empty room with two little iron beds and a straw mattress and an open fire with some bits of wood in it. But yes, we were accommodated there and fed in the dining rooms, the factories, and it was going to be quite good for a couple of weeks. Yeah, we're going to enjoy it there, and then we're going flying.
So what happened?
I think I went flying. I started flying in March the following year, I think.
So what were you doing? What were you doing at Cambridge then?
I started off drill. You see, you've got to have discipline. You've got to know how to obey orders. And so it was drill on the parade ground, and there'd be sports every Wednesday afternoon, and then we'd go to lectures, doing the things we'd been doing at Store Street. We'd do the navigation and the airmanship and the Morse code and so on.
What was the navigation like? What kind of...
Fairly basic. Well, it was basic. Assuming that nobody had ever done any navigation before. So it was all basic stuff. Triangulation, using a trigonometry. It was interesting. I like doing it.
Because obviously it would be something that would be important as you started your flying training. To understand the grounding
off. Oh yes, yes indeed. Yes, you had to be able to. We had a little box of tricks called a Coursand speed calculator, and you had to be able to use that so that you could work from the information you've got. You could work out the course to steer, and allowing for the drift from wind and so on. And then map reading. And then, of course, when we got to flying school, then you'd be given the task of working out your own navigation problem, whatever it might be. If you were given a triangular course, probably to fly, you had to work out each of the course and the new heading you had to take at the turn, and the new heading you had to take at the next turn, and so on. So we did all that, and little by little, one was able to find one's way around. But at the same time, having said that, we had no radio at flying school. All we'd got, really, was... and, of course, the Tiger Moth didn't have this wonderful blind flying panel. It had the old-fashioned basic layout, the airspeed indicator and altimeter, and that was about it.
Before you actually got to flying school, you said you were there until March 1940. Were you in Cambridge from September to September 39?
Yes, September 30 to well.
So you were at Cambridge from September till March.
That's right, 1940.
How did you spend most of your time there?
Well, I was at Magdalen College with about 100-150 others, and every morning we'd have a roll call from an aged sergeant who probably took 25 years to earn his stripes, and then we marched across to St John's, where we joined forces with the people over there, and we had one warrant officer, Mr. Dolby, his name was.
Wonderful warrant officer, Mr. Dolby.
And so we'd all form up out in the parade ground in front of John's College. I mean, wonderful setting, all the grounds and the college buildings and all the rest of it. It was really quite beautiful, although it was winter. Perishing was a terrible, terrible bad winter, that one. In fact, quite a few of us went down with flu one way or another, but survived. But little by little, they're really hard up to know what to do with us. They'd drill us and then tell us to go and put our running shorts on, have a cross-country run across the wastes of Cambridgeshire, or we go on a route march across the wastes of Cambridgeshire and learn all sorts of bawdy songs as we went and alarmed all the local peasantry. Then we'd go to the... Oh, yes, we had a link trainer. Now, that was something. We did get a link trainer. And this box of tricks sitting on bellows, which I could never really cope with very well. It used to make all sorts of wheezing noises.
But what did it actually do, the link trainer?
Well, it was... it was a dummy aeroplane set up on what's the word? Concertina things.
Bellows.
Set up on bellows. So this imitation aeroplane could, with the aid of the bellows, change attitude just as an aircraft would in flight. So you've got into this thing, and you've got this instrument panel in front of you, and they put down the lid. And, to begin with, they didn't put down the lid. To begin with, it was just a question of getting the feel of an aircraft's controls, so that when you push the stick forward, you know what would happen, and when you push it this way, and so on. So it was getting familiarization with the basic controls of an aeroplane. And they had a throttle lever, so you could adjust the speed, which came up on the airspeed indicator. But yes, it was within its limitations, it was good. Its primary purpose really was to teach blind flying. And that was when they put down the lid, so you couldn't see what was going on around you. All you've got was your instruments in front of you. And that was very good. I was never terribly good at it, some people. And it would also be connected to a trace on a chart on the table, and this little device would walk across the chart, marking out exactly where you've been. It was just a case of walking, of going from A to B and round in circles. That was easy enough. But when they said, now, we want you to trace out a course of the letter L, well, now then it became a bit more difficult, because you've got to get your legs right and get your courses right and so on. So it's within its limitations, it was good, and it was certainly a useful introduction to getting into a real aeroplane.
Did some people take to that better than others with the link trainer?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think instrument flying, I think, is very much an art, which some people have and some people haven't. I was a bit in the middle. I never performed terribly well. On the other hand, I don't think I'd have wrecked too many aeroplanes.
Do you have any memories of the people at that period, the fellow sergeants you were with?
Oh, yes.
Anybody who you remember particularly?
Well, the most famous of all was Johnny Johnson, top scorer. And Johnny Johnson was at John's, and so we'd see him every day. And Johnny, being what he was, in no time at all, became a favourite of our wonderful Mr. Dolby, warrant officer. And when it came to sports, we would all parade out there, and Mr. Dolby would appear and say, right, fall out on the left, the soccer players. So all those who want to play soccer would go after. Fall out on the right, all the rugger players. They'd all go over there. And so on, until there was one chap left. Guess who? Johnny Johnson. Sam Johnson, what sport are you going to play this afternoon? Please, Mr. Dolby, sir, I am going to blow up a football. Sam Johnson, fall out and blow up your football. That was Johnson, who went on to make quite a name for himself.
Anybody else? Any other particular friends you had at that time?
Yes. David Jeffries, who by pure coincidence, it happened that I mentioned my parents had this seaside house at Shoreham. And in the next door bungalow was the Jeffries family, one of whom was David Jeffries. So we knew each other down there on the beach at Shoreham. And lo and behold, we picked up in Magdalen College, Cambridge. Peter Flowers, Charles Dundas. Jack Robbins, Ronnie Hatt, Hatterwell, Porky Scott, and a few more, and I often wonder what ever happened to them all.
Did anybody acquire nicknames at that time?
A few, probably, yes. I think most of them brought them with them. Particularly those from the public school net, they seem to know each other's nicknames. But no, I don't think we christened each other in those days.
Because that's something that you do hear with a lot of obviously post-war material about the RAF, is the idea of the nicknames.
Nicknames.
Where that started from.
Yes. Yes. I think possibly if one was christened with a nickname, it would probably be in the squadron, rather than in the flying training machine. I don't think nicknames came into it at all in the flying training machine day. No.
So you were there until March, and then you said you went up to Perth.
Went to Perth, yes, number 11 EFTS, and did.
So you arrived at Montrose in March of 1940.
That's correct.
And what was the first thing you noticed when you arrived at the airfield? What was the setup on the airfield?
Well, there'd be this lineup of Tiger Moths, all ready to go. We were accommodated in little bungalows near the control tower. Or at least I think it was probably the CFI's office. We didn't have control towers in those days. And my first flight was Air Experience, which included familiarity with the controls of the aircraft.
Who would take you up for that first flight?
The first flight was in this case one Flying Officer Faller, F-A-L-L-A, and he took me up on Air Experience. But from then onwards, I was with Sergeant Vernon. And he showed me how to taxi and how to fly straight and level, how to climb, glide, and stall.
So with those things, if you could take them from the kind of basic period, because obviously you'd never been in an aircraft before.
Yes.
Was there any problems with the air familiarity side of it? What would they take you up and do? What was that first initial experience like in actual aircraft?
Well, what he'd do, the instructor was in the front in a Tiger Moth. Pupil always sat behind. And he'd say, well, now, here we are at 2,000 feet over the airfield. And I want to climb the aircraft. So first of all, I open the throttle to the required amount of revs, ease back the stick, and you'll notice the aircraft begins to climb. Leveling out, ease the stick forward, draw back the throttle to the new revs. We then turn to the left very gently by easing the control column over. Now I'm going to centralize the controls. I want you to put your hands on the control column and your feet on the rudder bar. And I want you to follow me through so you know what the effect is when I move the various controls in a different way. So we do that a few times and then come into land, and he shows me how to taxi the aircraft, bearing in mind that the wheels do not have brakes and we have to taxi the aircraft purely with the use of the rudder bar to turn the rudder, and the effect of the engine.